Welcome to What CEOs Talk About. Do you wonder what CEOs talk about behind closed doors? How they bring their vision to reality? How do they overcome and succeed through adversity? We share that and so much more with each episode. Now, let's get started with the show.
Good day, everybody. My name is Martin Hunter. I am the host of What CEOs Talk About. AJ, thank you very much for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited.
A word for our sponsors today. Sponsors is going to be a little bit different today. Usually, so AJ, when you are helping business owners, let's say, write books, what's the thing that they struggle the most with?
They struggle the most with confidence in their idea, that their idea is of value. And even if they're really accomplished, underneath that accomplishment is still that same fear.
And would you say that writing a book is just like a process?
Yeah, I mean, so it's a long creative process. It's a very specific process. But sure, yeah, it's definitely a process.
For those who are listening and not watching, behind AJ's right shoulder is a pile of sticky notes. And I, as people know, I have more sticky notes, 3M sticky notes, than a kindergarten teacher. Everything that we do in business is about defining a business flow. And AJ, just on the pre-show, was telling me, oh, this is a book outline. How is that any different than running operations in a business? So for those people who are out there, if you don't know, if you've got great ideas and you're struggling with your business, not in a bad way, but you're ready for an evolution, because I'm sure that the people that AJ, you talk to are people who are successful in life and they want to write a book because they want to tell a story. They want to tell their story. They're visionary. So just like anything else, it's a process. So if you're a visionary in your business and you're ready for something else and you don't necessarily have the capacity or capability, reach out to Urgio. They have the operational know-how to really help your business scale, merge, grow, optimize. You know, a lot of people want to grow their business by sales, but really if you look hard inside, just like a book, it's the story that you tell that sells. So what is the value flow to your customers? So Urgio helps with that. So thank you very much, Urgio, for sponsoring this message. All right, done with the sponsorship message. AJ, can you please introduce yourself, full name, what do you do, and then we'll go in your story of, you know, who you are, where you grew up, and what brought you here today.
Sure. I'm AJ Harper. My given name is Anjanette Harper, but everybody in the industry calls me AJ, and that's because when I started out writing books, it was easier to get gigs freelancing if people thought I was a dude. So I changed. Awful. Yeah, that's not the case so much anymore, but it stuck. So I'm AJ, but Anjanette Harper is my name. And I wrote a book called Write a Must Read after 17 years of being a ghostwriter, developmental editor, and publishing strategist. And right now, I'm talking about that book, and I write books with Mike Michalowicz, who's a business author. We've written 9 books so far. We're on number 10. You might know some of them as Profit First, Clockwork, Get Different, The Pumpkin Plan, among others. And I also teach a workshop for authors to help them write books that are truly transformational. And I'm head writing coach for Heroic Public Speaking, which is a magnificent speaker training group.
Fabulous. Thank you very much. AJ, what is the title of today's show?
The title of today's show is Write Better Books.
Three dots, exclamation mark, question mark, exclamation mark, with maybe a little asterisk. If it's Martin saying it, then there's certainly profanity in it. But anyways, AJ, tell us about you. Where did you grow up? Like, what's your story? Where do you come up here? How did you get to become who you are today?
So I love that you ask these questions, by the way, because I think when we write books, we tend, especially when we're business owners, we tend to omit that sort of content from a book, mm-hmm. and it really helps people get to know the author. So mm-hmm. I'm glad you're asking here because it's a good example of how that's helpful. I'm originally from Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I grew up in the Midwest. Pretty much just sitting at the feet of my mom, who was an academic and getting her PhD for most of my childhood. And I wanted to be a writer since I was a little girl. And I think it's because I was left to roam free in the University of Minnesota library stacks. That's, I'm a Gen X kid, which means our parents were really not, they were kind of like, see you at dinner. So,
yeah.
So I just read all the books, and then I read Little Women by Louisa May Alcott. And the character Jo March inspired me to say, oh, you can write books. Maybe I'll do that. But I veered left when I fell in love with theater. And I became a playwright for the most of... Starting at the age of 16, I actually had started with formal training and continued on that path for a long time until I had my son in 2004. And I realized I wanted to be home with him. I didn't want to be working crazy hours, workshopping plays, and having a day job. So that's when I said, what can I do to write and still take care of my little boy? Which is when I became a freelancer. Took literally almost any job just to...
As we always do, as when you start your own business. Yes. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. But within the first year, I had my first ghostwriting job writing a book. And that person happened to be pretty well connected in the personal and professional development world. So think business, self-help, spirituality, relationships, nutrition, right? And she hooked me up. And then the next person hooked me up and the next person hooked me up. So for 10 years, I wrote exclusively in that genre, books that are designed to help somebody change something, right? Yeah. And I learned how to write them really well and developed a system, which I then, once I retired from ghostwriting, worked with clients, perfected, and then turned into a workshop.
I have so many friggin' questions. So for those who have not listened to a few other podcasts, I am dyslexic. So I am a Gen X as well. And as only of late, dyslexia thinking has been really recognized.
Yeah.
So reading and writing has not been my forte. And therefore my forte was, how do I get out of reading and writing by keeping? So it opens up a whole different kind of brain aspect of what makes me who I am today. But no buts. Buts are for pants. And I've been asked over the past 6 or 7 years, Martin, there is so much that you bring to the table when you engage in clients. When are you going to write your book?
Mm-hmm.
When are you going to write? You've got so many stories. You got so many this. You got so many that. And I was like, yeah. And this is how the podcast was actually born. Because I was too lazy to write. And they said, no. I got interviewed for a podcast. And they said, the reason why I started my podcast was like, hey, I'm going to interview all these people and somebody is going to do the transcript and I'm going to pay somebody, I don't know, what, 15 grand, whatever it was, to extrapolate and write all of that. So that's how the podcast was born. So first question, how do you get into the head as a ghostwriter? How do you get into the head of somebody like me to write the best book, his book, her book, whatever? Because that's a skill in its own. Like, it's crazy how you can be able to do that.
Yeah, it's a really special skill. And there's a lot of people who call themselves ghostwriters, and they're really just working for hire, meaning that's the you know, the process, the logistics, the legal aspect of it, wherein they're writing a book and your name is, you're the byline, your name's on the cover.
Gotcha.
They don't have any ownership. But the true work of a ghostwriter is actually the art of listening, much like you described that you're good at that. So an excellent ghostwriter is listening to you, noticing your patterns and the way you phrase things, hearing you talk about your ideas, and then helping you crystallize them, but in your own voice. Some ghostwriters are not actually that good at that. So it's a really special skill of being able to become that person, but also help that person realize their vision and crystallize their message. I happen to be great at it because I did come from a theater background. So my approach to writing a book initially to get the voice right was just like thinking of each client as a character.
That is so true, right? So many people forget that there's an emotional component to everything. Like, Why do we read? What do we remember about a movie? Oh, I love that book. Why did you love that book? Well, because it drew emotions from us, right? Mm-hmm. I'm curious. I want to get to the title because I'm just going to keep on asking crazy questions. I want to get back to the title. Why did you choose the title Write Better Books? What are you upset with? What is tipping that title?
Well, you know, when I started in the industry, I took any job I could get. So there are a lot of people who just wanted to get a book done. And it was that was when people first started talking about a book as a better business card or doing what you're talking about, which is let me just transcribe my audio, get somebody to organize it. There's my book. And the reality is most people don't want to read that stuff. You know, they might want to read interviews with cool people for sure. But what people really want in the nonfiction genre is to be moved to make a change.
Yes.
And right.
I'll say that again. That is absolutely beautiful. Why do you read a book? It's because
you want to be moved to make a change.
Oh, that is absolutely beautiful.
So we can't do that if we're not trying to write the best book possible. And there's this whole school of thought in publishing, in one part of publishing, which is just get your book out there, get your book out as fast as you can, skip all these steps. And I think it's a discredit to the authors, actually, because it doesn't actually end up serving the authors as well as they think it could, because a book that people don't read, or if they do read, don't finish, or if they don't finish, don't act on, is not a book that people remember and tell people about.
Oh, there is so much meat in that. So as a business practitioner, as an owner and founder of my company, and I've started a few other businesses as well and exited, there are so many people out there right now, even my two good friends, fishing buddies, that have books. And they go, well, it's just a marketing tool, right? It's just a marketing tool. Now, I'll shout out his name, Dominic Rubino from Profit Tool Belt. The guy can write like there's no, he writes a book. He's like, yeah, I started on Wednesday and done on Friday. A very powerful tool book, right? It's like a recipe book, which I really think is okay. But his ability to pump out, he's got six books that he's not done. But he has not, he uses that a marketing material purposefully, purposefully. So I want to put that aside for now. But there's so many other people that just do what you did. They go, well, I wrote a book. How many copies have you sold? 12.
Right.
Like, right? So, oh, so what? Let's go down that path. Mm-hmm. What is your opinion? How do you feel about this situation? What can we do? What should we do? Open-ended question.
Here's the rub of it is I think when self-publishing became more acceptable, affordable, and easy to do, which was right around the time I started about 17 years ago, we tossed out all of these publishing standards and started vilifying traditional publishers and said, well, we can do this on our own. But traditional publishers have quality controls and systems in place to make sure a book is amazing, right? And so we made a mistake in trying to rush to publish, and just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Music to my ears, AJ. Right. Music to my ears.
But I have this little theory, and I can't prove it. There's no science here at all. But I think one of the reasons where a lot of authors are encouraged to just write a book in 90 days or just get it out there or write a better business card is because I think, even I don't think they're aware of it, but I think some people believe that you can't help a person write a great, great, great book because that requires innate talent. And so in lieu of that, what can you do? You can make it faster and easier, right? Mm-hmm. But the thing is, you can actually help people write a great book, even if they don't have the talent that you have, even if they have learning challenges, dyslexia, even if their English teacher told them they're terrible. The way to cut through it is in how you think differently about writing a book to begin with. There's a craft that I teach in my book and I teach in my workshop and that I used for years to write really amazing books. And it's centered around my message, which is a book is not about something, it's for someone. And when you remember that and you make the shift and you start to put your reader first, not your ideas, knowledge, stories, but them, what they need to get that change we talked about. That answers all these questions that you have, changes the way you think about the order of things, changes how you phrase things, changes every component of writing, editing, and even marketing the book. That now, even if you didn't know what you were doing, even if you aren't you got a C in English, your book is still going to be way better than it would have been before. And it sort of solves the talent question. It doesn't make talent irrelevant, but it makes it much less important. So focusing on the reader as a craft, not just in when you're thinking about who am I writing my book for, but literally on every page all the way through, and tracking reader experience cuts through that problem that people think, oh, I can't teach everybody how to be a great writer. Maybe not, but they could write a great book that's in service to the reader.
There, we say all the time, singularity of purpose. Let's pause for a second. I think we're going to use Martin here as an example for writing a book. There's so many verities in what you're saying about being just aligned to what's the output, and why is something maybe a little bit, what's the message, right? So for me, I've been struggling. I turned 50 this year, and I was like, okay, what was I started looking at, for those who don't know, ikigai, you know, your purpose, your true value in life. And so I work hard. I've got this great thing. So how do I contribute? How do I add more fiscally, financially? Prosperity is the word that comes to mind all the time. So what you're saying is that having that singularity of purpose at every single page, and that can be really applied to every single day that you operate your business. Anyways, there's so many things in my brain going bzz, bzz, connecting from what you're saying. It's no different. So let's take me for example. Dyslexic. If you were to suggest to somebody, because the listeners are just going to be listening, go, oh, what is AJ saying? How do I write this book? What's the path? I'm dyslexic. I think I have got a good understanding of what I want to deliver. How do I go about it?
So first of all, do you know Michael Port? Okay, Michael Port and his wife Amy Port founded Heroic Public Speaking. Michael Port also wrote a number of New York Times bestselling books. He's written 9 books, including Book Yourself Solid, Steal the Show, and most recently with Andrew Davis, The Referable Speaker. He is severely dyslexic. These are books that people talk about, recommend all the time. So I just want you to take that in, because that's actually not as big of a barrier as you think it is. It's a barrier for you in how you process, but it might take you a little longer. That's okay. That doesn't make any difference. Doesn't make your ideas, stories, the value you want to impart any less important.
Okay. So let's say I make a whole bunch of errors. So I'm writing books. I've got 27 chapters going.
Well, first of all, that's probably too many chapters. Just going to tell you right now. Unless they're super short. But let's fast forward so we can come back to the foundational piece, because that's important, because you said, where should I start? But let's deal with the anxiety around dyslexia. Okay? So.
Damn, AJ, I love you already. You're an amazing. you're boosting me up here.
I want to, because if people are asking you for years, you need to write a book, then that's something you need to answer that call. And so if I can help you do that in the next however long we have together, that would make my whole day. So let's fast forward, right? So let's say you've taken your time and you wrote a really good first draft. Not first draft. You edited, and now you have, because there are no good first drafts. Let's just, that doesn't exist. It's a myth. And no, there is not one person who's the exception to the rule. So but let's say you've done everything you can, right? You're going to hand it off. The cool thing is you're going to have a series of editors, all right? The first one is a developmental editor. That's what I do, which is that 30,000 foot view to make sure the book actually works. Flow, structure, tone, storytelling, what needs to go, what needs to be added. the big stuff.
Gotcha.
That person's going to help you, and they don't really, they're not bothered by if you got a word wrong or in the wrong order. Mm-hmm. None of that matters. They don't care about your spelling. They don't care about any of that stuff. Okay?
Gotcha.
Then once that part's done, now you're into copy edit. That person's going to fix a lot of the issues that you might be worried about. Grammar, punctuation, spelling, syntax. They're going to handle that for you. A good copy editor. And they're not judging you either. That's their job. They like finding stuff to fix. It's fun for them. They don't say, hey, who?
That's
they
what
don't
I do.
Say, who's this dude? You know, they have no judgment. And the cool thing is, if you get a good copy editor, you can actually learn some stuff. And then you actually have, if you do this right and you follow, if even if you don't do traditional publishing, if you at least follow the same quality controls they use, mm-hmm. you have a third one. That's mm-hmm. your proofreader. And they're going to find a bunch of stuff. And take heart, in my print book right now, there are 10 errors. 10 in my print book. And we had like 5 editors. So I just want to put your mind at ease. It's nobody in the editing team is judgy about a person who has some errors. And there are quality controls in place to help you out. So that part, you're good. Might it take you a little more time because you're dyslexic? Sure. But there's all sorts of things you can do to get around those things.
Wow. I think about it, it's funny because this is now turned around. I usually interview and help out people on the podcast. Now it's all about me. It's amazing how you have just demonstrated how the impact of the teachers that I had or the I don't want to call it oppression, but just you're not good. You're not good. You're not good. You're not good. You're dyslexic. You're good. I'm 50 years old and now I'm still being affected by some of the stuff that people said years ago. Although I've lived a full life. I've lived and worked on 6 different continents. I've got 4 kids. I've got a beautiful wife, happy life. Beautiful inside, not vain wise. She's a treasure. But still, with all of that, how you were able in a short period of time pinpoint that what? Wow! Thank you, AJ. Thank you very, very much.
You're welcome. First of all, I'm right behind you. I'll be 50 next year, and my wife will also be 50 next year and has severe learning disabilities due to a brain injury when she was a baby. So I know all about the dyslexia. She's got the number thing and the word thing and the thing where you talk to her and she twists it.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm really, so when I say you can do it, that comes not just from some sort of, rah-rah place. It comes from actually living with someone who has those challenges. You can, there's so many things you can do. And what matters more is that you care about your reader. The editing, there's this picture that in my workshop for authors, I use this picture all the time. It's this old timey picture, black and white, of firefighters holding, the trampoline they hold, and then someone falling into it. And I always tell people, the people at the bottom are your editors. You're falling, but they're going to catch you. And it doesn't mean you don't put your best foot forward, but they're going to catch you.
So what is the true value of having your definition of a good book or a bad book?
Well, if we're just talking prescriptive nonfiction, so again, the books that are designed to help someone make a change, right? A good book of that genre is one that connects with the reader where they are. Where they are. That's key. Respects the reader experience. So not just on page one, but all the way through. Respects what it's like to receive that content for the first time. Understands that how the reader is processing all the way through. And the most important of all is delivers on its promise. You've got to deliver on the promise transformation. Those are the 3 components.
So that delivery on transformation, that is really the tool set, right? What are the tools? What have you learned? The assimilation of information for action.
So here's the thing, is we tend to put, remember you asked me what are people struggle with? And I said, everyone's worried their idea isn't great. That stays with you. So that now you're promising this pie in the sky stuff because you think, well, I better, you know, tell them it's going to be amazing, exclamation points, yeah. all sorts of, maybe not false promises, but they're too big, mm-hmm. right? Or they're someday promises. You don't really sure. You hope so.
Yeah, gotcha.
Well, you know, I think of the promise to the reader as a sacred contract. And so that's more important that you think about, okay, what can I deliver within the pages of this book, provided they read it and do the stuff.
Gotcha.
Right? So the reader has to do the stuff. It's not like it's, here's your dream fulfilled.
Yeah, for sure.
But if you as an author are asking yourself, what could I actually pull off by the time they finish reading it and doing the stuff? And the cool thing is, it, you know, you can modify it then so that you can pull it off. Then that shapes the content.
Mm-hmm.
Now you have decisions that you can make. Okay, I probably have to change my promise and maybe tamp it down a little bit. Or maybe it actually elevates you and challenges you to come up with new ways to deliver it. Mm-hmm. Okay, if I want to get them over there, what else do I need to do? Are there stories I need to share? Are there action steps they need? Is there a framework I haven't thought of? Should I simplify this stuff? And it challenges you to think about that promise transformation, and that up-levels the book automatically.
So there is a new book culture in the past, I guess, 15 years, right? Bill Gates devours books, right? He goes on reading sessions where he'll read 8 or 9 books in 7 days or something like that. And, you know, every time we have a podcast, they go, oh, did you read this book? Did you read that book? You know, or every CEO should read at least 1 book a week or stuff like that. So in the new dawn of book reading and book writing, what's your take on it? Where is it? How do you feel about it? What's the definition of good? How does somebody who gets recommended 1,000 books pick the right ones? Like, how do we do that? I know this is a huge question. My mind is just blown by what you're saying. I'm going in different directions. So
that's okay. How do we pick the right book for us to read? Is that ultimately
what
you're asking?
Well, I guess, no, there's with everything that is, yes, but let me put some more context. There's so many books out there, so many mm-hmm. books, so many new authors, so many mm-hmm. people putting shitty books as you've defined. How do we really tell quick, well, not necessarily quickly, but how do we look for good in our qualifying of the next book that we're going to read?
Oh, what a good question. So, I mean, obviously recommendations, legit recommendations,
gotcha.
Not just I'm posting this because my friend has a book out, mm-hmm. but I loved this. You know, if you see someone who's puts a picture of a book up, they love that book. You know, they've got the pages dog-eared, highlight, post-its. If you see a well-loved book and you're out in the world, you're on a plane, you're doing business travel, and you see somebody getting out the pen when they have a book in their hands, that's a book you should probably read. And if somebody is verbally, just in conversation, says, I love that book, you should totally check it out. They love that book. They really did. Because the recommendations we do that are perfunctory, that's not really helpful. But when we remember a title of a book and we remember an author and even remember their core message for their book, then you know there's something there. I think also, let's not discount critical reviews. I think it's helpful to, you know, if someone has a critical review, meaning it came from a trade review such as Publishers Weekly, Kirkus, Booklist, Forward, there are a number of others, Midwest Book Review, that's valid. You know, that's validating. Mm-hmm. A lot of people who write a better business card, they don't go to the trouble to even get those reviews, mm-hmm. right? So that's another thing. But ultimately, let's just read the first couple pages.
Oh, as simple as that, right?
Yeah, let's just see. Is that you? Are they connecting with you right away? Or do you feel like it's going to be a minute before you even get to something of value?
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
Are you connecting in a way that makes sense to you? Does this resonate with you? Do you like their vibe? Do they see you? You know, I think it's our responsibility as authors to help a reader feel seen and understood, and they should feel seen on the first page.
Jiminy crickets. I say that all the time. I was like, so if you listen to the previous, I'll say three things that matter most to most to all human beings. Do you see me? Do you hear me? Do I matter?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So in the first couple of pages, we should be able to see ourselves, mm-hmm. make sure that we're heard, and make sure that we're seen. And I want to bring it back to what you said about where I am today. Is that correct? When you said where the reader is, I'm paraphrasing.
Oh, so this is a key thing. So this is where, and it's just because we don't have a lot of practice writing books. It's not because you have to be super smart to get this, but this is the thing. It's not where we want people to be. We have to remember that our readers, who are often earlier versions of ourselves, not always, but very often, mm-hmm. are in a different state of mind. True. You know what the problem is, but they might articulate it differently.
Mm-hmm.
You know what the solution is, but they may not be anywhere near ready to hear your idea yet. So getting them, really getting into the mindset of, from where are they starting when they open the book? And how are you going to get them further along in the journey where you can say, I know you think it's this thing, but it's really this other thing or and this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so in order to get them in, you know, enrolled in your stuff, you really have to show them that you understand their point of view, their circumstances. And it's not really about super detailed demographics. This is a key thing. It could be soccer moms, skateboarders, and CEOs. It's hearts and minds. It's what connects us. Mm-hmm. And really specifically, when you're thinking about who your reader is, it's answering this question. What do they want, and why do they think they can't get it? Where we go wrong is we say, what do they want, and why can't they get it?
Say that again. Okay. Oh, this is powerful. I need to hear this again.
Sure. So it's what do they want and why do they think they can't get it?
Why do they think they can't get it? Okay.
Right. Because we're further down the road. So we say this is why you can't get it, but they're not there yet. So in order to connect
on their journey,
you have to articulate and honor where they are, the things they've tried, what they perceive the problem to be. You can correct it. In fact, you can correct it in the first chapter, and you should. But first, you have to understand where home base is for them.
Oh, shit.
Right? This is where a lot of people go wrong, is they start articulating a problem, and they see it in their marketing, right? They're marketing a book and articulating a problem, but the reader's like, that's not my problem.
Yeah.
Because they think it's this other thing. You know different, but you have to connect to the thing they think it is.
It is crazy how book writing is associated with so many different things. Like educating our kids, right? Tracy tells me all the time, don't think like a parent, think like a kid. It's like you've gone through it. He's not gone through it. My boys got anger issues. I had anger issues and, well, still have anger issues. I just manage them really, really well. I can go Thanos on people sometimes. It's to put yourself back into the place. I coach rugby. I coach field hockey and rugby for many years. And I do that constantly. I say, okay, they're not there yet. So how do I break it down for them?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And so, yeah, exactly. Right. So instead of writing the book, and I'll use the word selfishly, I'm going to write a book for me, right? I want to use this. I want to put my face on there. I want to do this. I'm going to use it like that. It's what AJ, what you're saying is screw you. You don't matter. You're just the conductor. You're just the vector to which, or the key that unlocks the journey to where you are, but from where you were before for them. So don't be selfish and help them through their journey by thinking with them where they are, not thinking for them. Just like, hey, here you go. Here's a car. Get to school. Well, I don't know how to drive, Dad. Right?
Yes. It's being mindful of their journey. What's point A? Not just the end, right? You might need to do some heavy lifting to get them over to where you need them to be. And then mindful of reader experience also means thinking about where they might say, you're full of it, or that's easy for you to say, or I can't mm-hmm. do that, or you don't know my life. And just being mindful of what it's like to actually move through this book. If they've never heard it before, stuff that you're used to saying all the time, you could be rocking their world a little bit, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So are you addressing that? Are you taking care of them in that way? And there's all sorts of ways. You don't have to be touchy-feely about it. Mm-hmm. You could be a badass about it. But are you taking care of them? So that's mindful of the reader experience the whole way through. That's the craft. That's the craft of reader first. And anyone can do it, because you just ask yourself, what do they need?
It is, but you are correct. Not but, and you are correct. It is a craft to be able to put yourself as you're writing. For every page that you're writing, you have to really, really balance things out. It's not about you. It's hard because you're doing it. You're estimating, you're guessing, you're projecting yourself in the mind of the reader that's going to be reading your book 6 months from now as you're typing it away. So it's that's not easy. What will people say? What, you know, I can just imagine.
You could totally do it. And first of all, it's not when you write the first draft. When you write the first draft, it's just a hellfire mess. It's just a...
you said that before, yeah.
Yeah. So it's really in the craft of editing that you put the reader first. And you have to put the reader first in the beginning too, when you decide your message for them, your promise, and then craft a transformational outline. But then you just write. You just write. It's almost like you create your own paint by numbers. So remember those paint by numbers? Okay. So instead of your horse in a field, you make your own paint by number. You decide what is the image, what are the colors, gotcha. What are the ratios. And that's that foundational work you do. Instead of using a template someone else created, you create your own. That's gotcha. Designed specifically to deliver on the promise transformation. And then you write that first draft, and your only goal is to just get words on a page. That's it. It doesn't matter if they're spelled correctly, Martin. It's fine.
Thank you.
It does. None of that matters. Just get it on the page, and then the editing begins. And when you're in that editing phase, it's about creating an experience for the reader that ensures they stay in that book.
The I follow Tim Ferriss, who's written a few books, and he had a couple of points. Writer's block. He's like, just write 2 pages a day. Just write 2 pages a day. Just start writing, sit, just write. It will start. The other person who shares about writing is Ryan Holiday. He's a Stoic. So I believe in Stoicism. So I apply it as best I can. And then the last one, the one that just his voice and his writing and how he writes, is Simon Sinek, about leadership. Mm-hmm. And that is just the way he talks, the way he reads it, the way he writes it really connects with me. And so I see now what you're talking about. Before it just happened to me. I was just the recipient of all of this. But now I understand the process. And it just blows my mind how it is directly related, or it is exactly or very similar to running a business. Like running a business and saying, okay, what will my customers need in the future? How do I make sure that there's added value to their lives? It's not just about pumping things out day-to-day basis, but how do I manage safe production? How do I take care of the people that work for me? How do I make sure that the process is done properly so that the end user really stays in touch? So do the editors, is there a client engagement? Is there some type of way and methodology that you use to make sure that the book that is written will connect? Is there kind of...
So I'm so glad you asked, because I'm really excited about this aspect. I developed a system. So I have OCD, and I have the kind of OCD where you check all the time. So not the, you know, I'm always worried. Did I do the thing, right? Did I turn off the oven, right? And that translated to when I wrote my first big book. So I'd written a lot of little books, but when I've got my first big sort of, oh my gosh, kind of situation, I couldn't turn it in because I kept worrying, well, did I get this right? And because, you know, when you're a freelancer, you think, oh, I can't tell them I'm not sure about this, right? So I did what I always did growing up, which I always made my little lists, right? What do I have to do before I do this other thing, right? Mm-hmm. I had silly lists growing up, but this time I sat down and I'm, okay, what do I have to do before I submit it? Well, let me check to see if people can actually follow this concept. Okay, well, let me see if people can do the thing. Okay, well, let me see. And so I made myself a list for myself. Mm-hmm. To check. What happened over time, that was 15 years ago. What happened over time is it became what I call the must-read editing method. And it's a system of 17 things on a checklist. It's in my book. And it basically just walks you through one thing to focus on at a time. That's all designed to up-level your book and make sure you're mindful of that reader experience. So you look at your manuscript, not all the way through, right? Not word one, mm-hmm. page one, but you look for different things in the manuscript and fix them one at a time. Because I think new authors are not sure, what am I supposed to do about editing now? I don't know. Mm-hmm. But this allows you to go through just systematically thinking of the reader the whole way through, improving your manuscript on your own and learning how to get better at that before you even turn it in to your developmental editor. And so for folks who maybe can't afford a developmental editor, if they're self-publishing, this is essential that you would learn how to do it. But even if you do have a developmental editor, you know, I've got students who got publishing deals and then they were afraid to talk to their editors or argue with them or ask for what they wanted. This allows you to say, this is my best. Here's my best work. This is why I made these choices. This is what matters to me, so that you can have a real conversation with your editor and explain yourself versus feeling like you're being pulled out of your vision by your editor. So it's a confidence builder, but it also is the key to really writing that must read. And I just developed the checklist. It became the thing that was, a thing that was a challenge for me. This, you know, mental health issue, honestly, with extreme anxiety, became a gift to other people. Because now,
superpower, yeah.
Now my students are like, okay, I'm doing my checklist. I'm on number five, you know. And their manuscripts, when they turned in their manuscripts, their editors are, the last one who turned one in, her editor said, what is going on? I barely have anything to do here. Because their manuscript, they had just followed it to the letter. And these are people who've never written a book before.
Wow. It amazes me how your journey is amazing, right? So I have a problem. This is what I did. And I came to realize that, you know, my problem is a gift to others. Mm-hmm. So it brings us back, right? It brings us back to what I said before about this oppression button. That's
well done. Relate to what you say. Cause I'm born in 73. So there was nobody saying, hey, I think you might have this challenge, right?
No.
Remember then it was like you were either a sane person or you weren't.
Had mental issues.
And it was one or the other. And if it was the other, we probably didn't see you very much after that. Like, it was not cool back growing up in the 80s to talk about that stuff. And, you know, I'm a fully functioning person. I'm cool. And some days are harder than others. But when I'm in a stress situation, high stakes, that's when that comes out. Oh, no. Yeah. Did I get it right? You know? And so then I would obsess and not be able to turn stuff in. I know I'm not the only one who does this. So the checklist helps you feel like, okay, I did everything I could. I did everything I could.
It again, business-wise, follow a checklist. Yeah. Just follow a checklist. Pilots follow a checklist. Yeah. They have the lives of 300 people behind them. You know, they follow a checklist all the time. Oh, my goodness. All right. This is going to be a really hard question.
Okay.
One book. You're going on this island. You got your family with you, and it's the perfect island. You're going to feel comfortable, everything, but you can only bring one book with you.
Dang.
Which one is that?
Is it fiction or nonfiction? Can I pick one of each?
No, you can only bring one. You can only bring one. That's the trade-off. Fair. You can only bring one book.
Okay.
What is the book that you're going to bring?
I'm going to bring my favorite book since I was about 16 years old. and it's called Love Medicine, and it's written by Louise Erdrich. And she's now a Pulitzer Prize winning author, and it's an amazing book. And I would bring that with me and read it over and over again.
And why is that? What's the emotion attached to that book?
Well, I discovered her when I was a kid. It's the kind of book that the prose is so good, all of a sudden you're reading it out loud. Like, you didn't even catch yourself till suddenly you're just reading it out loud because it's so good you have to hear yourself say it. And characters are just, they break your heart in all the best ways. She's a truly gifted writer. I mean, there's no one like her. And it opened me up. I actually mentioned this in my book. She's the reason, that book is the reason I thought, oh, it's not just about being a writer like Jo March and Little Women. This is about what you could be as a storyteller. It gave me a super high standard, which I'll never get to Louise's level, but it showed me what's possible in storytelling.
Okay. Now I will let you bring another book that you have not read yet.
Oh, okay.
And you're going to say, okay, so you've not read yet this book. What's the second book that you bring?
I haven't read it yet. I've been wanting to read it. That's a good question. I have a very large stack of books that I still want to read. Let me see. God, this is hard. You're really putting... I should have been ready for this one.
No. But that's my gift. My gift is to really listen.
You like stumping, right? You like it when people are stumped.
It just... It's not being stumped. Is my question was valid enough and good enough for you to be able to think about
it? Yeah, I like that.
Because I want to draw the emotion attached to it. Like, okay, so then the next question will say, why have you picked that book? So it kind of defines who you are and what you're looking to become.
Yeah. There's a book that's called Intuitive Editing, and okay. I've been wanting to read that one, and it's more about fiction, but I'm getting ready to start working on a novel, and so I want to read that book and understand that a little bit better. I'm afraid to say I don't recall the author, but it's called Intuitive Editing.
That's all right.
Yeah, I've been wanting to read that one.
Okay, last question that's going to I don't want to say stump you, okay? So you're going away. What's the one book you give your boy?
Oh, man, my boy. Now you're going to make me emotional. It's called Illusion, and it's written by Richard Bach. He wrote Jonathan Livingston Seagull. Do you know those books?
Yeah.
Illusion. Illusions, and plural. Why? Illusions.
Why?
Because I want him to see how our perception of things create our reality so that he can have his dreams.
Well said. Well said. Is this fun?
This was one of the... I've been on a lot of podcasts, Martin, in the last couple of weeks, and this was probably my fave. It was pretty good.
Thank you so much. All right. Let's leave the people with what's the name. So your book and somebody else's book. Somebody wants to write a book. Somebody wants to tell a story. Pick a guy like me. So you're going to say, hey, Martin, what's the two books? One is your book. That's for sure. If you want to write a book, what's your book? Can you recall the name of the book again, please?
It's called Write a Must Read. And you can get it anywhere books are sold. And if you want to write a book, then I have to recommend, and I always recommend it, it's The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield.
Gotcha. Those two books. Fabulous. If anybody wants to reach out to you, I think you're on LinkedIn, and you have a website, ajharper.com, I believe.
ajharper.com, and then there's also writeamustread.com, which has cool free tools and resources for folks who are in the process of writing a book.
Fabulous. With that said, AJ, thank you very, very much. I could go on for hours with you. This conversation about book writing, it's very topical for me, so I truly appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, and I can't wait to hear about your book.
Well, you and I are going to talk. With that being said, thank you very much, everybody, for listening. Please like, subscribe, and click the notification bell to know when the next episode comes out. Thank you very much from What CEOs Talk About, where we translate strategy into frontline operations. Thank you and have a wonderful day.
Thanks for tuning in to What CEOs Talk About. Make sure to click subscribe to get notified about future episodes or check us out at www.whatceostalkabout.com.